You can get air and water from like a chunk of ice that's circling Saturn, but you can't get cheese there. Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, Terrifying Robot Dog Book Club. We're going to talk about Leviathan Awakes from the Expanse series. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next. Welcome back.
Yay, we're back.
Welcome to season 5, dear listener. Episode 1 of season 5.
Yes, we've made it to 5 seasons. Wow.
Very exciting. Well, today we are planning to geek out about Leviathan Wakes, which is probably the best science fiction book I've read in as long as I can remember. This ought to be fun.
I love this series.
I'm jealous of you that you're ahead of me. You've read the whole thing, right? Like,
I've read the whole thing.
How many books is it? Like 6?
Six books so far. There's another one coming out this year.
Nice. Yeah. So I just finished the first and I started the second. Oh, man. These are the best sci-fi books I've read since I can't remember when.
Yeah. Since like The Martian.
Oh, this is way, in my opinion, is way better than The Martian.
Yeah. The Martian is an entertaining experience, an entertaining collection of ongoing catastrophes.
Yeah, exactly.
but this is good hard sci-fi.
Yeah. I put this, so I would say that this is, and this is saying something. I think that I liked this particular book, Leviathan Wakes, better than Ready Player One, which is saying something.
Yeah.
And I'd almost put it up in Neuromancer Snow Crash territory in terms of enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, this is going to go down as one of my favorite sci-fi books of all time. So not to overhype it or anything. I think Neuromancer and Snow Crash were very... They're sort of iconic in the sense that it's so many things they predicted and terms they defined, and it seems like reality is imitating art in a lot of ways. But this one is just pure like action movie joyride through, you know, some future. Do you know how far in the future it is? I forget.
I think it's about 200 years.
Yeah. So we've got all the fun stuff: space travel, space stations, blaster, everything.
Yeah.
Right, and it's not just, I think I just said an action romp, but it's also very, what's the word? It gets really internal also.
Mm-hmm.
It gets really into like the ways people think about things and their like feelings and all that stuff. It's just so great. The level of detail is unbelievable.
Yeah, sorry, did you have more to add?
No, I was just going to say, spoiler alert, big time, because we're going to blow the book for you. If you now are excited to read it and you have not yet, you should shut this off, because we're going to wreck it.
yeah, we're going to wreck it. Stop here. Because if you're at all interested in reading it, you don't want us to wreck it for you. You want it, because it's a page turner and you want that. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So if you're still listening, we are basically just going to geek out on this.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. We don't have any real formal plan here.
No. So what should we do? Do we need to summarize it for people who decided not to read it?
Maybe we should. Yeah, if you want to do that.
Yeah, otherwise it'd be totally confusing.
Yeah.
Oh, man, where do you start? So I guess the book really centers around two main characters. And, oh, God, how do you start this?
Yeah, you get an alternating view from these two main characters. And the story, the setting of the book is, it's a couple hundred years from now, and Earth has gotten super crowded with, you know,
30 billion
people. Yeah. And we've kind of expanded out, and there's colonies on the moon, and we've colonized Mars and also moved out into the asteroid belt and the outer planets, sort of mining resources and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And from that has sprung up three basically political factions out of that, which play very central roles in the book. And it's, not only do you get like a really good view of the politics surrounding all of this and what it's like living in these various environments and just interacting and growing up in an outer planet versus growing up on Earth all your life and that sort of thing. But then there's also this sci-fi horror type plot that pulls you through the whole book as well.
Right. Yeah. It is kind of horror, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So just to give a little color to some of that. So like one of the things that comes up in the book constantly, there's hardly a page that goes by, certainly not a chapter that goes by, without talking about gravity.
Yes.
Which is just the coolest.
Most sci-fi books just kind of skip over and ignore it, and they're like, it's either we spin to make gravity, or we're weightless and it never really comes up again, or we have this magical artificial gravity.
Mm-hmm. And it's such a central part of the book, as it would be. So it just feels really real because it permeates everything all the time, mm-hmm. whether you're on a ship or not. And, you know, planet, asteroid, doesn't matter. Gravity comes up. And it's so wild because obviously for people who just live on Earth, it's perhaps one of the most constant constants there is. And to have it suddenly become like variable from like the beginning of your walk to the end of the walk is just radical. So like if you're on an asteroid in the belt, as they call it, the asteroid mm-hmm. belt, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way I understood it is when they make a station on an asteroid belt, they basically drill out some kind of like catacombs inside of it. And then they set the thing spinning so that the gravity is kind of like centrifugal force.
Yeah. Toward the outside. It's kind of like that. There's two main forms of gravity that they create throughout the book, and it's spin gravity and thrust gravity. And the spin gravity is what you would get on the stations, and like you said, that's going to vary and change the closer you get toward the center of the asteroid versus the outer edge of the asteroid. And they talk about the Coriolis effect and all of that.
Right, like if you go up to one of the poles, so you're standing like on the center of the top, so to speak, or upside mm-hmm. down. It's, you know, they're like, oh, he could feel the Coriolis effect in his knees. Or for people who aren't used to, you know, earthers, as they call them, who aren't mm-hmm. used to, never mind a different gravity, a constantly changing one, or one where it gets lighter as you go closer toward the center, they're just like walking weird and stuff. They can tell where people are from by the way they're walking. And it's like super wild.
Yeah. And I love the way they travel between places in the book, and because it's, and I'm not sure, this might actually be jumping ahead a little bit, but it might be mentioned more in the later books, but it's just a technical detail, so it's not going to spoil anything for you. But I believe they touch on it in the first book, is the way you get somewhere in space is, it's not like you go fly somewhere and then you hit the brakes. There really is no such thing as decelerating in space. You're just accelerating in the opposite direction. So like if they're flying somewhere on a long flight, you're accelerating toward it. You're about halfway there or whatever, and you flip and then you burn the other way until you slow down and you're at your destination.
Mm.
So there's that flip mid flight.
Yes. And they do talk about it in the first book, it's not that you're never stopped. You're just moving relative to something else
mm-hmm.
at the same speed. It's so insane. It's just like crazy to think about all the time. It's so cool. And one of the, perhaps the most visible, effects of this gravity is that in the belt, the gravity is lower. So the people who, you know, generations of people have been born and grown up and died there, and they're like 8 feet tall.
Yeah.
And skinny. So they're like aliens, you know, they're humans, but
it changes your anatomy growing up in the low gravity environments. And even the people who live on Mars have this to a slighter effect, because Mars gravity is one third Earth gravity. So even they experience this to a lesser degree.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's cool when it comes into sort of the politics of the book. I mean, politics is definitely one aspect, but it's also a class system.
Mm-hmm.
That these different societies have very different, they view each other differently. They view each other, you know, if you're an earther, you view people from the belt in a particular way, or people from Mars in a particular way, because generations have gone by where huge chunks of the population have never even been on Earth.
Right.
And they look different, they act different, and you know, human stuff happens, like the normal human stuff, like even on Earth, when you're just sort of see somebody who's, I don't not see somebody, you're interacting with someone from a country that speaks a language that you don't, or whatever. It's wild to imagine, to kind of extrapolate into the future that it's like some things never change, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of is a good example of that. I mean, we're hundreds of years into the future, and there's still racism and classism, and I guess in one respect, that's kind of a little bit of a bleak way to look at the future, I guess, but I think it's a realistic one, as much as we would like for these things not to exist.
It would have been weird if it just magically disappeared.
Yeah, if it had gone Star Trek Federation, everyone gets along with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, this feels much more real and much more genuine and much more honest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, people who've lived and died and grown up in the Belt are going to have a completely different set of priorities, because when you're living your life in low gravity and environmental suits out mining asteroids, your priorities are air first and foremost above anything, water, resources you need. And I guess you become very protective of those in ways that people, even people from inner planets that are out in space, in ways that they don't, because they haven't grown up immersed in that environment where it's so vital and those things are so fragile.
Yeah, it's a big plot point that people from the inner planets, especially Earth, but I think Mars would agree too, they don't respect or they don't understand or they'll never understand. You'll never understand what it's like to grow up where air's not free and water's not free.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a hilarious story about cheese smugglers. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
There's nowhere to get cheese except for Earth. So you know, you can get air and water from like a chunk of ice that's circling Saturn, but you can't get cheese there.
Right.
And there's a hilarious story from one of the main characters, who's basically a Belter detective who grew up in the asteroid belt, about confiscating, you know, people who were smuggling Vermont cheddar.
Yeah.
And they confiscated it. And it was, you know, it was like the street value of this block of cheese is like a million credits.
Yeah. And the funny part was everyone was like, so you were the reason for the cheese shortage?
Right. It's so hilarious. Like everybody remembered the cheese shortage.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of like gray market and black market activity, but it's just so richly detailed and consistent with the premise, you know, that that people are, you know, like Belters don't joke around about people stealing their ice, because that's their air, that's their water. And if you grew up with free air and free water, you'll just never understand like why is everyone rioting just because a stupid ice freighter got hijacked. Like that is life. That is our life. You don't mess with that stuff. It's like, you know, that's just totally off limits. It's hard to think of anything on Earth now in the current day that is, I mean, oil, I guess would be oil.
I guess maybe, but.
But still, it's not even close to air.
Yeah, it would have a big impact, but not as much as air. And can we talk about language for a minute?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that the Belt has developed its own language, so to speak. It's a Creole language, just a sort of amalgamation of different cultures and slang that's come in that's related to their work over time and just evolved from that. And it's I love the detail that they put into that. And they go into, actually there's an Expanse sci-fi television show based off of the series, and they actually go into a lot more detail of officially and correctly developing the language for the TV show. But I love that detail. And it's funny because you look at some of the Belter slang and some of the Belter phrases that have been translated, and one of the biggest insults you can the biggest insult you can give a person is that, oh, you know, I hope you have a hole in your spacesuit. It's like
right. Yeah, like that's a big thing, like spacing somebody, you know, like, I would just like chuck people out an airlock. So yeah, there's no reason to bury the body.
Yeah, no, there's harsh punishments for things that affect vital resources, and you're pretty much going to get yourself tossed out of an airlock.
Mm. Yeah, the language, I mean, I never actually read it. I just listened to the audiobook. You've done both, right? Like you read the physical or whatever, you read the book.
Yeah.
And then, so I've detected French, Spanish, German. It's a complete mix. And then, like, I guess the Mars, which was settled first before the Belt, there was a big Texas contingent. So everybody there, even though a lot of the population, I guess,
like East Indian
is East Indian.
Like Mars was basically settled by East Indians, Chinese and
Texans,
like West Texas. Yeah.
But the Texas accent infected everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have an East Indian pilot with a West Texas drawl.
Yeah. That must be even better on the show. I haven't seen the show yet.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. And the actor does it so well.
That's so good. Yeah. Is the show, should I be nervous about watching the show for two reasons? One, am I going to spoil, like, should I finish the books and then watch the show? Or that's one risk. And the other risk is it, does it just stink?
You can start the show and watch the first two seasons by the time you get about halfway through Caliban's War.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, will do. And you think it's good. It's fun to watch.
The first season has some pacing issues. It kind of drags a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still worth watching because it's very true to the books and very good. And the pacing issues are mostly fixed by the second season. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, the second season's better, but I still think the first season is really good. It's one of the best sci-fi television shows I've seen in a very long time.
And you've seen them all.
And I've seen them all. I would say it's the best one I've seen since Babylon 5.
That's meaningless to me, as having never seen it, but I know you like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure dear listener likes it.
If they're still with us, they might well, yeah.
Yeah. I think I was living in a van when that came out, so
probably
didn't have a lot of TV. I was doing my music thing.
Yeah.
So another thing that came up a lot, and I think that it was of great attention to detail, was that when they were operating in a vacuum and the communications that they used, and there were a bunch, it was like very real, it was very human, you know, that, you know, people who grew up in the belt spend a lot more time in spacesuits than everybody else. And they have this kind of, they don't like nod with their head, they nod with their hands because nobody can see your head inside the helmet. And mm-hmm. when they are, if they're in a vacuum and their normal radio communications are down, they have to touch their helmets together and yell so that the vibrations have something to go across.
Right.
Which I was like, oh man, who thought of that?
Right. I never would have even thought of that.
But yeah.
It makes sense. But
yeah, there's nothing. If yeah. you're just yelling in a vacuum, there's no way, nothing to vibrate. So
right.
Other vacuum stuff. There's of course, they're always talking about food and like, you know, you better hurry up and drink your coffee because we're about to go to zero G and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the normal communications inside the helmet, when they're talking about, like when they're doing some sort of a team operation where like maybe they're going into battle, you know, like whether it's ships or on the ground, it's not 100% clear how they do the switching, but there's elaborate switching between who's on the channel at any given time.
Right.
And that they can transfer visuals. So they've got like heads up displays and they can transfer what they're seeing to other people. And they can, it reminds me of a Slack room almost, where people can like pick right. different channels. So like 10 people could all be communicating in four different channels, depending on the privacy levels, desired privacy levels. And I don't remember how I don't remember them ever explaining how they switch between channels, but it's something they do in a very fluid way. Like, do they ever indicate that in the show?
Yeah, I'm thinking they do, but I can't remember off the top of my head how.
It would be hard.
I'm thinking it is touched on in the show.
It's like, it's something, and I do recall one section, although I don't remember, I recall one section where they used their foot to activate or deactivate or change channels in the communication. I can't remember though, but that would make sense. It would make sense if it was your toes, because your hands are almost, you know, you're in a battle, you're busy, right? And how would you, it needs to be done in some way that is like very, very fluid to be able to shift, you know, between talking to the captain of the other ship and your XO and your ground team and the engine room and the weapons guy and the pilot. And it's just so great.
Yeah. I don't think they go into a lot of into any detail about how that's done, but I do think there is a mic button that like you can activate to turn your mic on and off with, like, I think there's a button that you can hit with your chin or something, but
yes, that might be one. It might've been chin, not toe. I always get those confused.
Yeah. They're so similar.
Nice toe chin.
Hey now.
Chin cheese? No.
No. Let's. Anyway, moving on.
Moving right along. So, okay. So maybe we could talk about the horror aspect.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a little.
Yeah, that was very interesting. Interesting approach they took to that. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, why don't you? Can you sort of summarize the overall plot of the book? The sort of evil corporation finds alien tech thing.
Yeah. Well, it's just what you said. Evil corporation finds alien tech. Is colluding with such and such governments, but we're not sure which ones or if it's only limited to one. And the gist of it is that alien tech is found on Phoebe.
Moon of Saturn.
Moon of Saturn, yes. So of course humans find it and these scientists are trying to understand and develop and control it. And it's it's technology that's basically, it's organic technology that pretty much consumes the genetic material and information of whatever biomass it's tossed onto and incorporates it into itself. And I don't know, it's kind of like a great big blob of alien stem cells.
Right. Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Just kind of grows into...
It's like carbony.
Yeah, I can't go into more detail about what it does without spoiling the next book for you.
Yeah. So did you ever see Big Hero 6?
Yes.
That's how I picture this stuff. So they had these little nanobots that almost like little magnets. They looked like little magnets that could kind of like, they were sort of free flowing and the person who was controlling them could turn them into whatever. And that's not really like this. This more like grows organically.
Yeah.
But it's... It, am I imagining that it's black, but I don't remember if it's carbon.
I don't think it's,
or silicon.
I don't know if they ever say, but
yeah, but it, I pictured it as like carbon filaments and it's very spiny and scary and it sort of inhabits, well, it's kind of like a virus, but that can expose it, that kind of like explode out of the host into its own thing. If it gets enough bodies and radiation to incubate it. Here's the thing that you might need to bite your tongue. Okay, so
okay.
The premise in the only thing in the first book that I thought was an unexplained assumption, because they did an amazing job filling any plot holes. Every time I was like, oh, that, why would that happen? And they almost immediately explain why it's not a plot hole. Supposedly, this alien tech was fired at Earth 2 billion years ago.
Yeah.
And was captured by Saturn's gravity. And I guess the whole moon was the projectile. And it just got captured by Saturn's gravity. In the entire first book, unless I missed it, which is possible, they never explain how they know that it was 2 million years old, or however old it was. They never explain how they know it was pointed at Earth and not Saturn. And they never explain, and they constantly refer to it as a weapon. But they never explain how they know that this alien godlike civilization was trying to annihilate life on Earth. It just seems like this huge outstanding assumption.
Yeah, they are making some assumptions in the first book. And first of all, let me just say that we do know for a fact that the moon of Phoebe is an extraterrestrial object that got captured by Earth or Saturn's gravity. Like the actual moon of Phoebe.
In real life.
In real life.
Extrasolar.
Extrasolar, sorry.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Some sort of asteroid that floated into the solar system got caught by Saturn.
Yeah.
In real life.
In real life.
Okay. Just double checking. Okay.
Yeah.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So, but yeah, they are making an assumption that this was, in the first book, they're making the assumption that this was a weapon or that it is a weapon. And I think the reason they're making that assumption is because they're looking at the devastating effect that it has on a human.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to take in mind that if this was hurled at Earth 2 billion years ago, it was hurled at Earth before humans even existed.
Right. It could have been a care package.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So
it could have been it could be just communications.
Yeah, it could be. They say it was hurled at Earth 2 billion years ago, and they're calling it a weapon because
it ruins your day.
It's destructive. It ruins your day. It's destructive. And to be fair, the scientists that are trying to understand and manipulate and use this are, they talk about wanting to do things other than weaponize it, like using it for building technology and improving, you know, so maybe you can go outside in space without an atmosphere and that kind of thing. They talk about it for all of those purposes, but their interest in weaponizing it is pretty strong.
Right. It's almost like, you could sort of imagine it. I feel like it would be more accurate to picture it like fire. It's like discovering something on the scale of fire, but even bigger, like order of magnitude more important for the race. Like, yes, fire can burn down Chicago, but it can also heat your house, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I don't know that if there was any kind of plot hole in the first book, I would say that's it. It doesn't really matter because they have to act like it was a weapon. But the fact that they ascribe the intention to the other species seems like a leap.
Yeah, you're gonna learn more about that backstory in the later books.
Yeah, so. I can feel you dancing around it. So, so I'm looking forward to that. I mean, like, who even knows if because one of the evil scientists at one point is like, you know, we have no choice but to figure out how to develop this, because when this race that has attacked us will, you know, they're not going to just go away. I'm like, well, it's been 2 billion years and they haven't knocked on our door since. So.
And there's no guarantee they attacked you.
Yeah. And who knows if it was an attack? There was nobody here. So.
Yeah, they could have just been like, oh, it's a nice planet. I think we'll use it. And this was supposed to, I don't know, turn it all into farmland or something. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Oh, right. I'm looking forward to plowing through the rest. I'm looking forward to having my life back when I can stop listening to this every free moment. What else? So many good things. I mean, you get the book has everything. It has everything. It's got love story. It's got like more facing your own mortality. It's got everything.
Yeah, it's even got like Philip Marlowe detective film noir type.
Yep. Yeah, it's a little pulpy. It's got some laugh out loud hilarious parts. I mean, there are some of the characters are just a scream, just a riot.
Yeah.
It reminds me of you must have watched Firefly, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there's some crew interactions from Firefly that I feel like are kind of echoed here, where you've got a mishmash of people who have different degrees of loyalty and they're just completely different backgrounds and they're kind of smashed together and hilarity ensues, you know. It's like, and they're all facing like imminent death any second. So it's like tons of gallows humor from this pastiche of people from all over the universe. It's a freaking riot at times, and other times terrifying. I mean, the writing is so good. Like the prologue of the second book was making my heart rate. I was like freaking out. It was so creepy and scary.
Yeah, and actually I was reading the prologue for the second book and I was reading it and thinking, oh man, I hope John doesn't quit the book at this point.
It's very scary. Very. Just so creepy. But anyway, it's like so good. Love it. So I was goofing on the author's name at one point, because it's like one of those two middle initial names. And you were like, actually, it's a pen name. Two people wrote it, which I think is, I can't think of another example of that. There must exist, but I don't recall ever being aware of a novel or sci-fi, you know, that's a novel, I guess. It's like a fiction book written by more than one person.
Yeah, and I mean, fiction books written by more than one person is not unheard of. I don't think it's super common, but it's certainly not unheard of. But I don't know that I've ever heard two people come together and share a pen name.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I can. I mean, usually, like, I'm used to seeing, you know, certainly, like, business books would be like, you know, this guy and that gal and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But, or maybe, like, my autobiography by me and somebody who actually wrote it. And,
yeah.
You know, memoirs and stuff. But I've never read a book that I know of that had two authors. And I wonder, you know, who knows, but it really feels like, because there were at least six situations where I detected what I thought was about to become a plot hole and then it was patched. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, right. I didn't think about gravity, or, oh, right. I forgot that, you know, whatever. And the other thing was, probably more than any other book, perhaps barring Harry Potter, there were twists in this that I didn't see coming at all, that were just like completely took me by surprise and were awesome. Just completely unexpected. Like, wow. So good. Tons of them. And I feel like, I don't know, you know, who knows? I just feel like
a collaborative effect.
Yeah. I feel like that's the kind of stuff that comes out of a collaboration, because it's so easy to, like, you know, get high on your own farts. It's like,
right.
You just like, oh, I know what should happen here. And I mean, come on, Doctor Who.
Right.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Constantly. Yeah.
Oh, I know. Let's just time travel. It's okay. Great. You know?
Yeah. I feel like that's a good point. I feel like the collaborative effect sort of helped close up some of those plot holes and explain things and give interesting twists to it. From my understanding, it's the authors, Daniel Abram and Ty Frank. And from what I understand, one of them, I forget who, one of them wrote Miller, the character of Miller, the other wrote the character of Holden, which is the two characters from whose perspective you see the book. Mm-hmm. And then they edited each other's chapters.
Yeah, whatever they did, it worked.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, and I think they've continued to do it that way in future books, with more characters and everything. Like, they'll each pick a character and then they'll write for that character and edit each other's work. And they've done it so well. It ends up, it feels like it's written by one person. Like they've done a really good job with, like, the characters have their own voices, but at the same time, it feels cohesive. The writing style is cohesive and feels like it's written by the same person.
Mm.
They did a really good job with that. It doesn't feel like you're reading two people.
Yeah. It's not disjointed at all, but you inhabit each character though. When they like a chapter title will be like the person's name. And it's like, you know, Holden, you know, chapter five, Holden. So you like immediately know, okay, we're going to be inside James Holden's perspective. And it'll pick up a lot of times right after the last one, like, you know, the last Miller chapter will end with him and Holden doing something. And then it'll like pick it up from Holden's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't switch into first person mode ever.
No.
But it just starts to follow that person and talks about their inner, like if they talk about inner thoughts, it's like that person, not the other one,
right.
Which would have been, I wonder, it probably would have been pretty confusing without those chapter titles.
It probably would have been, but there's a lot of books that do that. And I've dabbled in my closet fiction writing different characters, stories from perspectives of different characters and giving them each different voices is really hard to do because it basically all ends up sounding like your writing style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's, and I don't think they do a poor job of that, but it is something that's, and I've certainly read books that do it much worse, where without the titles, you wouldn't know which character was the focus. And sometimes in the middle of the chapter, I have to go back and look at the title and be like, okay, whose perspective is this from? You know, I've read books like that before, and this certainly doesn't suffer that fate at all.
No.
But yeah, writing different characters and giving them all different voices is very hard to do.
Mm.
But they get better at it as the books go along.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, I remember reading that in Harry Potter, there's only one point in all of the books where they inhabit anybody, where they go internal mm-hmm. into anybody's inner voice, except for Harry. She only did it once in the troll scene in the bathroom when Ron defeats the troll. It like goes into Ron's thoughts for a second. But other than that, I don't think there's a section anywhere where they talk about like Hermione's inner voice or anything like that. It's always Harry.
Yeah.
Which I never thought about until after I had read the whole thing and I was like, you know, going down that internet rabbit hole that you do after you finish something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, that's wild. But this one does, you know, this one handles it in a different way and it's like super effective. So cool. I'm trying to think if they do any, in the second book, they start to introduce more characters and they will do stuff from other people's perspectives. But I was very happy to see that they included some of the people. I wasn't sure if it was going to be like a completely different story in the same universe or if it was going to be a continuation or like where it was in the timeline or any of that.
No, it's a continuation. And some of the characters are present in every book and some of them drop in and out.
She said, like, I'm guessing.
Oh, no, that wasn't what I meant.
Oh, okay. Another thing I read about this was that of the two authors, I don't remember, I think, would you say it's Daniel somebody and Ty somebody?
Yeah, Daniel Abram and Ty Frank.
So one of them, I think it's Daniel, is like pretty basically a famous writer. Like he's written on Game of Thrones and he's written a bunch of stuff. And the Ty guy wasn't a professional writer, but had created the universe for a role-playing game.
Right, yep.
And somehow they met and the guy who was, you know, writing as a profession was like, man, this universe rules. Like, how did you come up with this? And like, what do you say we write a book about? Like, create some stories inside the universe and write a book about it. And the rest is history, I guess. Super, super good.
Yeah, it's quickly become one of, if not my favorite sci-fi book series.
It's completely booted me out of my previous obsession with the stream, the unending stream of superhero shows that have been coming out of Netflix.
mm-hmm.
I was like really, really down the rabbit hole with those, and current most recent one being The Arrow, which is it's entertaining and it's okay, it's pretty good, but this is like world class. So now I'm like, all right, I'll be back to you, Netflix, after I go through this Audible phase.
Yeah, like you mentioned Ready Player One earlier, and it's almost not fair to compare them. I mean, they're both science fiction, but they're two completely different approaches, and I think serving two completely different functions. You know, Ready Player One is supposed to be a fun,
yeah,
entertaining romp, and this is supposed to be hard sci-fi that gets you thinking.
Yeah, this is serious business. This is like this is like sci literature. Sci lit. Is that new? Do we just invent that? Sci lit.
I think you just invented it. I'm not sure I want to lay any claim to it.
Sci lit. Sounds like a piece of your eye. Anyway, so it is, I mean, it's great. It's just great. I have nothing else to say. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, we could go into more details about plot and stuff, but there's no point in spoiling it too heavily, I don't think.
So, yeah.
People have either read it and they know, or they don't, and they could probably still at this point go out and read it and enjoy it.
So. Yeah, I mean, honestly, we haven't really ruined it, right? I mean, just sort of like some things to look forward to, but we haven't really given away any too many of the twists. Right. All right. Well, dear listener, if you regret your decision to have listened to us jabber about this without having read it, I think you're still probably safe.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, you can plow through the first book and then move on to the others.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's a long book, so there's no way we spoil the whole thing.
Yeah, it was like 23 hours on Audible or something like that. Yeah. Holy mackerel. In fact, we were going to do this earlier last season, as they say in the business.
Mm-hmm. And we just didn't have time.
Yeah, I'm like not going to finish it in time. Like,
yeah. Yeah, you didn't finish it, and I hadn't read it in a long time, so I was listening to the audiobook, and I hadn't finished it either. So,
Yep. All right. So that's probably. Do you think that's good?
Yeah, that's a good place to wrap it. I mean, like you said, we could talk about this for days, but I think this is good. Cool. A good spot that's not going to ruin it for people who still might want to read it.
Awesome. That's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next time for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.
Would you like to see Kelly and I in your inbox once a week? Get new episodes delivered straight to you with show notes, links to additional content, and so much more. Plus, you can reply to any message to suggest topics for future episodes. To get the inside track, go to terrifyingrobotdog.com and look for the Keep Me in the Loop button. That website again is terrifyingrobotdog.com.